is Dialogue Conspiracy, a public affairs presentation of KLRB News. Dialogue Conspiracy is a program which shares the political research of Mae Brussel. Her almost 10 years of work are based on the theory that government is moved as much or more by conspiracy than by any democratic process. Dialogue Conspiracy figuring prominently in the discussion and in the vocabulary of the program, I'm sure, will be a caper called, not a caper, but the Watergate affair. Most of the national news media refer to it, or have referred to it in the not too distant past as the Watergate caper, but May, you don't really like the word Watergate caper, do you?
No, I don't like the word Watergate caper because it's the cover story for something which is very serious, but the tone of the exposure of what's happening in Washington in terms of corruption is becoming very serious now. The people who called it a caper or a light fantastic are realizing now that something very big is happening and they can't put their finger on it. And there's an article in the New York Times this last Sunday called Watergate, It Isn't All That Funny.
Let's get to the New York Times in a second.
Okay.
First. There's a teaser for people. What about Dialogue Conspiracy? What is it about?
Dialogue Conspiracy, for those who haven't listened before, is a program where I try to give information about the past political assassinations in the United States of President John Kennedy, Senator Robert Kennedy, civil rights leader Martin Luther King, the accident at Chappaquiddick that took place to Ted Kennedy, the shooting of George Wallace at the shopping center in Maryland, are all part of a large conspiracy, I believe, of the same persons interrupting the electoral process. Every one of these accidents, the murder or the accident or the near murder, has to do with the election of who maintains the power in the United States and is directly related to the containing that throne in the White House. And I've spent years researching, mostly in the beginning, the ballistics, the fingerprints, the weapons that were used in each of these murders, and realized that the bullets and the victims didn't match the guns that were left at the scene of the crime, that the Justice Department never investigated the crimes, the FBI wasn't interested in finding out who did these things, and they're classified, in my mind and many people's minds, as conspiracies.
Okay, so it's sort of a current events program with ties to the past and a great deal of research constructing those ties, right?
Well, what we do each week, we take the news of the week and show how it relates to the past political assassinations or conspiracies that are going on at the present time. The value of the show now, talking at this time, is that these conspiracies existed when we first went on the air a year ago, June. It was so outrageous to talk about them. A lot of people weren't considering them or even thinking about them. But so much has been in the news about James Ray and Sirhan the last year and those trials and the shooting of Wallace, and you can see the discrepancy in the bullets. You're reliving what happened before over again now. And people can begin to understand conspiracy better. And the Watergate, what they call the Watergate caper, which I believe is tied into the extreme right wing that was planning the killing of Richard Nixon, is not a caper, but a very serious game of a clandestine group in the White House that intended to overthrow the White House. Now, these are serious charges because as long as the men didn't achieve what they wanted to do, they can deny that that was their purpose.
And they have been denying that in the press the last few days.
They haven't been actually accused of the charges that I've made yet. Now, I've talked to Don Edwards, a congressman, this week. I talked to the writer in the New York Times. And they're just wedging their way into the conspiratorial link of the CIA man at the Watergate that were arrested and the past political assassinations. This is like growing grass through cement. It's taken 3 months of pounding away, spreading information, And it's seeping now into the news and into their stream of consciousness that maybe something serious is happening.
Yeah, I interrupted you at the New York Times. Do you want to pick up there, or do you want to?
Well, I have the article here of, just because you said it was a caper, that this particular writer, Walter Rugeber, is saying it isn't all that funny. And what they begin to talk as a caper in Washington is a slapstick with an air of unreality has a lot of explanations that aren't coming in yet. And
you said that a long time ago, and you objected to the Watergate caper title.
Yeah, I wanted to call it the Watergate affair, like the perfume affair which rocked England, the scandal. And it is a scandal. This particular scandal is being made subject of cartoons all over the country. You know, I take 8 papers a day, and the Washington Post will have a reprint of a Milwaukee paper cartoon, and the Miami paper will have a reprint of a Michigan cartoon, and they're using each other's, and they have all kinds of cartoons. They have Kleinitz and Richard Nixon sitting on a chest, and it's about to explode. It's like a bomb. It's a great big round thing, and they're sweating it out, and they're holding the lid down, and they've got signs all over, and little powder puffs are seeking out, you know, like a bomb ready to explode, and they've got the ITT money and the secret $750,000 money and the $150,000 offered. Klein is to stop one case, and Mr. Stewart, Nixon's friend, getting Justice Department to call off a case in San Diego, and the milk fund, the raise of milk prices, because $350,000 was given to Nixon's campaign, and Andrews getting a bank charter up in Minneapolis, giving $25,000 to Richard Nixon.
The list goes on and
on. It goes on and on, but the subject of the cartoons, Time Magazine had one this week of this skeleton coming behind a door, and Marie Stans is holding the door back, and there's a lady, like a voter, holding a person. She comes to Mr. Stans, and he says, I assure you I'll have an answer as soon as I think of one. So the public, Marie Stans was a well-known Wall Street lawyer and banker, and he's the subject of a lot of criticism. Oh, here's the cartoon. I brought in Phil, says, believe me, I can explain
this. Let me hold this up to the microphone here so people can see it.
Like television, yeah.
We have our limitations, folks.
It's a cartoon of a skeleton behind a door, and they're standing there holding the door back, and he's sweating where he stands. And he said, believe me, I can explain this as soon as I think of something.
This is almost as good as the Sunday Funnies on KGO. This is really good.
Yeah. Well,
you got any more we can try out on people?
I've got a lot of I have a whole filing section of just cartoons.
It's funny that, not funny, but interesting, that some of the cartoons that have been run, the editorial cartoons in some of the papers, have been more pointed than some of the editorials that usually run next to them.
Oh, yes, but the editorials are coming in very serious now. And there was one article this paper this week that I want to read because it's a memo from Charles Colson, the special counsel to the president. And Charles Colson is the CIA liaison between the far, far, far right-wing radical group. A lot of people say, well, why would anybody want to get Nixon, or why would anybody overthrow the government? Isn't Nixon as far right as you can get? And I say, oh, no, he's really a liberal. He's not as far right as you can get. There's a whole team from California to Florida, across this nation, from New Mexico and into Washington, that are ready to take over. They have Agnew right in position, and they think that Nixon is a cop-out. He served their purposes for a certain amount of years, and now they want to get him.
Okay, so now to Charles Colson.
So Charles Colson is a White House staff member right next to Richard Nixon, a CIA man who hired Howard Hunt, one of the men who is being arrested with regard to the Watergate affair. He was at the hotel at the time 5 men were arrested, and he got away. And he was at the hotel, and Colson for the White House was the one who had hired him.
Where did this memo appear?
This appeared for the Washington Post and also the New York Times. And Colson had a memo to the White House staff dated August the 28th, that's this week. And his memo reads to this effect: there are 71 days left between now and the election, and every one of these is a campaign day. And every day, let me remind you, has 24 hours. Now, sometime during the campaign, you can recharge your battery. An occasional Sunday may be possible. Don't count on it. I want to make it perfectly clear what the policy will be for 71 days. No one is to plan any trips anywhere without my express approval. No one should be out of reach of the telephone. The White House switchboard must know at all times where everyone is. Each individual member of the staff should ensure that he or she can be reached any time, night or day, by phone or page boy. No speaking engagements will be accepted. No trips will be planned without my knowing and approving in advance. Many of you have been through campaigns before. They are 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week job. If I offend any of you, he says, come around November the 8th. If I have bruised feelings or injure your morale, I'll be happy to make amends on November the 8th, assuming we have done our job and the results are evident. I can understand that you have gotten the wrong impression of me since so many erroneous things have been printed lately. Just so you understand me, let me point out that the statement in last week's UPI story that I once reported to have said I would walk over my grandmother if necessary is absolutely accurate. Signed, Charles Colson. Now, this is an indication. I have a copy of memos and activities that Lyndon Johnson had in the White House, and he kept track of staffs. He was very paranoid after the assassination of John Kennedy, and he began to step up a lot of surveillance, and he kept a staff record of every person on his staff who went out for dinner in Washington and who they ate with and who they saw. And they had to keep a regular computer type operation. They had to check in and out of who was seeing who. Now, Charles Colson is a defendant in this lawsuit against the party, and he's a very important person. He's right next to Nixon in the White House, and he hired Hunt. So that nobody's going to squeal or talk. They are practically prisoners of Charles Colson. They can't go out and meet with somebody like UPI or AP. They're not ordinary citizens who have a life separate from the White House. By page boy or by phone, night or day, and you can't go anywhere. We may give you a Sunday off, but don't count on it.
So are you saying then, again, that this is evidence of the tight control, that there, if this control weren't exerted, that some of the GOP staff people might be saying some things related to the Watergate?
Well, I think it's a very paranoid attitude, and I don't think the re-election of the president is endangered by these people taking a day off if they work 6 days a week.
Unless something
is happening. He says, don't be lulled into a false security by the polls that show the president ahead. They will change. He said, make every day count. I feel that this country has become paranoid and repressive beyond any imagination of most people, and to get a picture of this kind of memo shows that a lot of things, I feel a lot of violence is going to continue in the next 2 months, and they're going to be on an emergency basis. This is almost like an order, sit tight at the door. Charles Colson is giving an order. Either they can't see anyone, or they have to tell him who they see. It's a dictatorial. I take it as being much more than is necessary to reelect Richard Nixon. And in lieu of the circumstances of his tie-in with Hunt, I think it's a little bit oppressive and over. But he's given the order, and they have to respond to that or leave. Now, Julius Hobson is running on the Radical People's Party in Washington, D.C., along with Spock. And he sent a letter to Representative Don Edwards this week and asked Don Edwards, who's chairman of the House Subcommittee on Constitutional Rights, to get into that $10 million secret fund that we hear about with Richard Nixon all the time. And he claims that we have to know before the election if Richard Nixon is funded by the CIA. Now, I brought this in to share with you because my article in The Realist suggests that Nixon has been funded by that invisible government since 1945. But only through the fluke of the Watergate did we get a chance to see how the money is channeled. And we talk about that this week. I'm going to read a cartoon that was in the paper this week, which isn't funny, but it is, on the way the money is handled for clandestine activities. Did you see Buchwald's cartoon last week on the money?
No, I haven't.
Clandestine money.
It's going to turn into the Saturday Funnies program.
Well, Saturday Funnies. See, Hobson is saying, you know, the lawsuit against, the criminal suit against the men that broke in at the Watergate Hotel and the civil suit are being investigated and prepared now, but they're dragging their feet with every excuse. So, it will come after the election, who's involved and what happened. So now they've presented to a member of the Congress the fact that we have a right before the election to know if Nixon represents an agent of the CIA.
Are we going to get in today a discussion of the Common Cause suit, which is tied in with those funds?
Did you see the wording this week of the paper of the attorney for Common Cause? It was in Thursday's paper. He said, you can't sue the committee to reelect the president because we're only a committee set there to nominate him, not to reelect him. They use every word. That has to be scraping the bottom of the barrel. He said it was only set up to nominate him, not to reelect him, so you can't sue us.
Yeah, the committee to reelect the president was only
set up to nominate
him.
So why don't they disband and go home? You see, Maurice Nans was given a new high position in that committee this week.
I think that they're going to change the name to the committee to really reelect the president.
Well, I don't know how they have the nerve. How do you think he has the nerve to say that?
That's a joke.
Yeah.
I mean, have to label my jokes from now on.
I know your jokes. I'm just trying to think how an attorney for the President Nixon can say we're only set up to nominate him when they're going full swing.
President Nixon said that nobody in his president's staff was involved in the Watergate affair, but he didn't refer to, you know, his staff at that time, and he's an attorney.
That was picked up in the papers in the East. In fact, they're using espionage reference now to the activity. I brought in two articles, one from the Newsweek that says that the secret money, this $350,000 Stans account, could be used for covert operations, and Time magazine uses this quotation that you did of President Nixon, where he said, "No one in this administration presently employed was involved in the bizarre incident." And Time magazine says the operative phrase was presently employed, because four members of the White House have resigned, quit, or been fired since the arrest. John Mitchell, Hugh Sloan Jr., Howard Hunt, G. Gordon Liddy.
So they're pretty top names, really, and they were on the staff of the White House or directly associated with it.
That's right. So Time magazine has an article called The Watergate Royals On, you know. And they're aware that this is a big story now, and they are coming out finally and saying, well, the president says this, but that's his operative language.
Sure. We challenged people last week to explain or to defend the president. I assume since we had no takers, that everybody saw right through that particular, what Time calls the operative phrase.
Yeah, well, there was an article by Carl Rowan in that Monterey Herald here, and he said maybe people aren't incensed because it's a question that all elections are done by crooks, so you just choose your own crook. It doesn't bother them what's happening at the Watergate, but the important thing is to visualize it at your own level. If you leave your home and go somewhere and somebody gets in your desk and photographs your papers or your letters, you'd be really angry if it happened to you.
Well, I think it's a question. I'm wondering whether you don't agree that most people have a sort of shady picture of politics, that politics are somewhat corruptible, that this sort of thing is sort of expected. It's part of the ground rules.
Yeah, but you see, we're talking now in an age where you have a choice whether you're going to bomb a war and escalate or not bomb, or bomb dikes and starve these people out, or use napalm or electronic warfare. And if you get a man that represents the aerospace industry, the plays people that give him money, that finance the oil companies, that finance the weapons manufacturing, then he's going to give them their war because they put him in office. That's why it's so important to find out who's funding Richard Nixon, and always was, but nobody seemed to care, is that do you justify the war and escalate? If you got no money from the people who were carrying the war on, and you got a lot of money from people that were building housing in the slums and schools and hospitals and trade schools and places for education, would you be more into a domestic scene if the domestic people could give you the money that the warfare people need?
Granted, that sounds logical, but you haven't answered my question. Don't you think that the public expects a certain amount of graft and corruption and sneaking and spying?
Well, they can't afford
to
anymore.
I mean, but do they expect it, do you think?
I think the
public...
Do you think
that's part of the reason why the public isn't as incensed as you and your friends or personally?
I think the public accepts anything. They accept... If they vote, go to the poll and elect a president, he's killed, they just accept the man he chose as vice president. I think the people are numbed by this indifference. I spoke with a group of students that came to my house this week from Santa Cruz University and from Palo Alto. And I suggested that if you're incensed about the assassinations or the archives being locked up or not having access to who funded Nixon for the $10 million, just knowing that your milk's going up and the war is escalating and people are getting bank charters with that other money that we've had a peek at, then start a boycott. Maybe a college is starting, and I'm going to be talking to different colleges, campuses, and maybe the young people through various newspapers and the underground press should begin to boycott certain stores just on the basis that if you don't pressure the government, we care, but we can't do it alone, and if you don't pressure the government, we'll make our own bread, we'll make our own clothes, we won't do any Christmas shopping. You know, Christmas is coming up, and we just won't go in your stores if the campus is starting, say, at New York with WBAI and Santa Cruz and Stanford here. There are a group that came down to see me and get it to Berkeley. We have a list of things we want to know, and I brought in a list of secrets. And
it may just happens to have a list of secrets.
See, I have a list of secrets that the kids should know, and if you're not going to let us know these things, we're going to say Mr. Safeway or Macy's or whatever stores, we'll just stay away, make a list of 20 places in each neighborhood and say, because you're not pressuring a Mr. Tunney or Cranston or your congressman, to get to the archives to find out who kills the presidents and senators, we're going to boycott you in our hometown.
Okay, but that's assuming that people care, that people feel that this isn't be expected from politics.
No, the young people care.
You're putting your hope there, then.
I've had a lot of young people. There was a law student that came down to the house, and his uncle is prominent in politics in the McGovern camp. His father's a professor at Stanford, and he goes back to his father and says, this information on John Kennedy's autopsy or on the gunman is locked up in the archives, and the professor at Stanford doesn't care. So he teaches at law school. So the students, a group of them, wanted to see how they could get the father to care. So they sort of went to different students and had seminars about the assassination and said, now let's take it to the professor and see what he does as a teacher, not as a father, but as a teacher. So they were ready to, when school opens in September, the boys try to get his father interested, and he doesn't care. So the students will approach to him like, if you're a professor, why don't you do this? The young people care, and there is a generation gap, and the only way you're going to break it is not through logic, but by putting them up against the wall, counting the bullets, and saying, now what are you going to do about it? If you're a phony, just shut up, and if you're not, produce. And this is what they're going to do with this particular professor, who's the son of one of the people who's interested in the assassination. Time magazine, just finishing this one article, said if the Watergate controversy is stilled, the larger furor over Nixon's campaign funds may go on. McGovern said, I have no doubt, but what this issue will catch fire. You cannot make a serious bid for the presidency of the United States anymore and cover up a secret fund of $10 million. See, that's the secret fund. I brought a list in of some of the secrets I talk about. Why is it important to get that $10 million fund that was closed off before April the 7th into the news? When the men were arrested at the Watergate, a few checks that showed up in the bank of one of the men arrested, Bernard Barker, gave an inkling of how Nixon is funded, because one man, that Mr. Andreas from Minneapolis, gave $25,000 to the committee to reelect the president, and he handed it to another friend from Minneapolis down at a golf course in Miami, and both of them just right afterwards got a bank charter at Minneapolis for a savings and loan bank, which is usually hard to get. And he got this bank charter in a hurry, and both men are going to be on the board of directors of that bank. The milk price went up just with these donations to Nixon, and they had said flatly, we won't raise the price of milk. Then the people went into the White House and sat with Richard Nixon. The price of milk went up. Now, there's a question.
Coincidence.
$89,000 was in the bank account of Bernard Barker in Miami. And I keep bringing it up for the last few weeks because the channeling of that money is so important. It goes from four men in Houston, down up to Washington to the committee, then to Mexico, where a man now who received that money says he doesn't know about it. Somebody else, Mr. DeGuerra, doesn't know about it. Then it goes to San Francisco and Chicago, and then it ends up in Miami at Barker's account. Now, this is clandestine money. No matter what you think they're going to do, this is not just plain, simple losing. They call it washing it, to lose the traces of who gave it to Richard Nixon. If a Democrat in Houston, Texas, thinks Nixon's the best president for him, he should say, I give you $30,000 or $100,000. I'm a Democrat. You know, there's no law that if you're a Democrat, you have to vote Democrat. And we should know who wants Nixon in, because later new laws are passed. And he works with Perot, Ross Perot, the billionaire from Blue Shield, Blue Cross, and the prices keep going up on the cost of Blue Cross, and their profit went up $10 million this year, and yet the medical care prices keep mounting. With no control on that, our Blue Cross bill came last week. It's $200 every 4 months for Blue Cross protection. That's $800 a year. And the same week that I got the bill, I read that they had profits of $10 million this year. Profit of $10 million on a health service, they're raising the cost. And out of that profit, Perot made billions, you know, off of Medicare and Blue Cross. And what if he...
We're going to change the medical system.
Well, oh,
this doesn't fit in, but I've been meaning to say this somewhere for a long time. I think it's in China or Japan, where the doctors get paid when you're well. As long as you're well, they keep getting paid. As soon as you're sick, you stop paying until you are well again.
Oh, really?
That makes more sense.
To keep you well.
To keep you well. That means that preventive medicine is something which doctors will practice for profit.
Or
keep you well because the money will keep in. It doesn't have anything to do with dialogue conspiracy.
No, it has something to do, because these groups that fund the president, if they make huge profits off of your health or body, You have a right to know. We're off on a tangent, but the secret money is in the news so much that it's good to analyze what all the fuss is about, you know, of putting Richard Nixon in. And if men fight socialized medicine in this country, are they putting money into his campaign? Are the richest doctors keeping people from having medical care by funding him? You know, that has not to do with the political assassination.
Probably I'll find out that it isn't Japan or China. Somebody will correct me, but it is one of the countries that does that.
Where they pay you to keep well.
Where you pay the doctor to keep you well instead of to fix you when you're sick.
Well, some of these secrets that have to do with political assassinations, which I listed, that the students could work on is, number one, that $10 million fund, which is the way clandestine money finances assassinations. When a guy like James Ray spends thousands of dollars over a $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 in 1 year period, the money comes from somewhere, and you have to wash it, change hands, and do a lot of things with it before it falls in his hand. The Lincoln Club is a secret organization formed in 1963 that finances and puts Nixon into power. We don't know who the members are. How do we know the way he votes, the way he looks at the war, the way he looks at the domestic problems hasn't something to do with the money people give him to stay in office? The National Archives should be opened up. That's something the students, if they have a boycott, if we can get a boycott going, it'd be on certain terms that we find out who is locking, we know who's locking the archives, but we want to know why they can't get in there and have an educational process of what was in there and what could be learned if people could get in and examine the evidence and the testimony of Robert Kennedy's murder or Martin Luther King's or President John Kennedy's. And then the Tyrol Club, this last week, McGovern finally made a speech hitting Nixon's tax plans and his loophole for the oil people, and he referred to John Connally's private oil clubs, you know, that keep John Connally going. Well, and the Tyrol Club in Jamaica is the world headquarters for the syndicates, for British intelligence. It was formed Mr. Stevenson of British intelligence and John Connally and former Nazis and white Russians, and we should have the name of everyone who lives on that island. Not temporary guests or anything, but who does John Connally associate or live with? This is a secret club like a James Bond thing. We don't know who attends this club. I have a lot of information that indicates we should know who John Connally meets with.
Okay, we'll have more on this list of secrets you should know on part two of Dialogue Conspiracy after we take a break to rest our throats and identify the station that you're listening to right now.